So this is talking with Anthony Hewish at Cambridge.
No age.
Anthony Hewish at Cambridge on 19th August 76. Now, I think you came here as a research student originally, is that right?
Yes.
And when was that?
That must have been 1948.
And coming in as one of the very first ones, how was it determined as to what you worked on? Was it simply Martin Rowell said to you, well, we're doing this? And
yes. To begin with, let's see. To begin with, I had charts and I was cutting them up into days and nights, actually. That's
Bruce Elsmore just, gave me,
piles.
That, just gave me that same story.
But I don't think I did that for more than a day.
Okay.
About the very first job I had was designing antennas for the first survey, radio star survey. When I got there, radio stars, as they were called, had just been discovered, Cygnus and Cassiopeia,
right,
were known about. And the next step was to have an antenna which is a bit more directional and just make the first real sky survey.
Right.
And the first job I ever had was to design an antenna array to do that, which was a broadband array at 80 megahertz.
This is what became the Long Michelson.
Yeah, that's right. And I designed the, I got the dipoles and the feed system going for that.
Mm-hmm.
That was just stooge work in a sense, you know. I mean, I was a new pair of hands. This thing badly wanted doing, and I did it.
Now, did you have any radio background?
No, I was in radar during the war. I mean,
oh, that's right. You came from
RAE. Well, I spent RAE and TRE actually.
Right.
So I knew about
That's right.
Electronics and so forth.
All of that early group came from TRE, didn't
that's
they?
That's right. Yeah.
So, were there any new principles in this Long Michelson?
None at all. It was just absolutely standard, really.
And did you have any idea how many radio sources you were going to be turning up, or radio stars?
Not a bit. No. That was absolutely unknown.
So what happened when you turned it on, so to speak?
Well, I didn't actually turn it on. I mean, this was very much a group effort. It was going at the same time as I was doing my own programs. I mean, you don't always design equipment for yourself in this group. And that was the thing I did the moment I came. But in fact, the first research I did was on the Sun.
Well, in fact, I was thinking you were a co-author of the 1C. I'm sorry, you're not. That's right.
No, I'm not a co-author of 1C.
Yeah.
No.
So you helped with that.
Oh yeah, I did a lot of design on the antenna, but I didn't in fact do the work with it. I was concerned in those days with very initially with the Sun. I mean, the radio Sun was the most rigorous active radio source known, and it was a period of fairly intense sunspot activity, and I did some work on the polarization of the rapid bursts. I designed a polarimeter, and did a little work on that. It never got published because it wasn't terribly interesting, and it got overtaken. My interests then went to the fluctuations, and that was, I mean, after about a year, I was deep into the fluctuation story,
which was 49 or so.
around 49. Yes.
Yeah.
I was analyzing. In fact, the thing that that triggered me off on that was that I was analyzing records taken with the. It was records taken with the 80 megahertz array, which was doing the sky survey, and it was just running records day after day. And I had to. I was analyzing these for the fluctuating signals on them. We weren't sure then what they were. They could have been ionospheric, or they could have been intrinsic to the source. We didn't know, and the sources were coming through with sidereal time, of course, marked on the recordings. And I noted that after we'd looking back over a run of several months, that these things actually the scintillations were only happening during the night, and I was the first person to actually notice that. And that really got me interested in the scintillation story. And from then on, really, I was concerned more with the ionospheric fluctuations. Well, I mean, they turned out to be.
But you were looking at these records to investigate scintillations.
Oh yes,
right.
I mean, I was looking for daily variations, actually, of it day to day. But what I noticed was that when you had a year's data to look at, as the sources slipped round in solar time,
right.
So they scintillated during the night. And in fact, the diagram that comes up in that first Rowell and Hewish paper, that was where it was all published. Those diagrams were the ones I'd plotted, you know, soon after I came here, actually.
I see.
And that really got me interested. You know, I mean, I'd done something for myself. It was a new result. And I got quite interested in it.
But I'm a little confused as to what the general feeling was Hayes' original discovery of the Cygnus fluctuations was 46. Mm. And there's a period in there where, looking at the published literature, it's difficult to understand what people really thought about these fluctuations. Can you?
Of the fluctuation? Yeah, well, I mean, when we started, we didn't know what it was. And it was really the long baseline. It was comparing fluctuations here and at Jodrell Bank and actually also at Defford. I don't know if that's got into the literature anywhere. There was a paper with Graham Smith's name on it, and I think Lovell's name on it, and maybe somebody else.
There were two papers together.
Two papers together, yeah.
Right, Smith and then Little and Lovell.
Little and Lovell, that's right. Well, I was in sort of, it was the diurnal variation I discovered just about the same time as that. And, of course, that really clinched the ionospheric origin. And from then on, I tried to, my interest then was to see what you could learn about the ionosphere. Given this new technique. You see, it was an ionospheric group. I mean, you understand that in the Cavendish it wasn't just radio astronomy then, it was Radcliffe with the ionosphere and so on. So I had a background of ionospheric physics, and my immediate interest was to catch radiation that's gone right through the ionosphere, because this gives you data which just pure reflection techniques don't.
Just a very good probe of the whole thing.
Yeah.
You say you had background in ionospheric physics.
Well, I mean, Radcliffe...
Taking courses around
here. Yeah, that's right. Just the ordinary graduate courses and third year physics courses.
But I don't think you've still answered, was there a raging debate for a few years as to the nature of these things, or was everyone just throw up their hands and said, could be intrinsic, might be in the ionosphere?
Oh, it was 50-50. It wasn't a raging debate. I mean, it wasn't really that exciting. I don't think people were really hopping up and down about these things. But I remember when Radcliffe said this must be the ionosphere, we rather joked at him and said, well, you know, he can only think about the ionosphere.
Right.
It's probably astrophysical.
Yeah.
But in fact, you know, we laughed a bit about that, but he in fact was right.
Right. So this is in fact what got you off into this whole business, of course.
Of the fluctuations,
really the whole
I mean, I've
got
going
on
the theory after that. Yeah, absolutely. Right. I mean, that led straight on. I mean, I forgot
the sun. You just moved out to one medium. I'm waiting for you any time now to get into intergalactic medium fluctuations.
That's the last one, right. Yeah.
Or maybe fluctuations in the 3-degree background would,
yeah, something like that.
Would do it,
yeah.
Also. But anyway, as you say, Ryle and Hewish in 50, and then you published a paper in Proceedings of the Royal Society.
That was a theoretical one.
In 51.
Yes.
And using what's a common model now, a diffraction screen model.
That's
was
right.
This entirely new at that time?
Yes, it was new, yeah. I noticed the link-up between the diffraction theory and modulation. I mean, I think I was the first one to really know how a phase screen operated and get some quantitative information out of it.
And there was similar work going on in Australia, at least from an observational point of view. Did you know about that?
I mean, we knew that roughly what was going on down there.
I mean,
but their thing wasn't so much a nocturnal scintillation. They always had a slightly different story to us. They had daytime scintillation, and my first theories on this were that it was to do with the ionospheric fluctuations called spread F. There's a thing called spread F, which is something you get on the P-F reflection records. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, I've heard the term, but I didn't.
Yeah, it's simply a multiple echo, essentially, from the F region.
And you can tell different frequencies.
No, this is just the ordinary, you know, the ordinary sweep frequency technique,
right,
where you send pulses up and you gradually increase the frequency, and you get what's called a P-F record.
Right.
When it penetrates, you just get long delays, and the record kind of goes along and flips up.
So that's what spread refers to.
And the spreading is actually a sort of multiple reflection height. The end of it, if I can plot P-F for you, I can't draw P-F curves, look something like that.
You're right.
And then you get, this is the ordinary ray and that's the extraordinary, something like that. And you're just plotting delay. Let's see, what are you? Can't remember what these darn things are now. What is P-F? This is frequency, and P-F is, it's really delay, I think. And the delay increases as you penetrate, because you get the you get the imaginary refractive index business. Well,
right.
this thing just spreads up, and you get
you get
a fuzziness like that, which is called spread F. And I found a very high correlation between scintillation and spread F, which told us it was an F region thing, high up, you know, 300
right.
kilometers. And you said what were the Australians doing? They were having daytime scintillation as well, and they thought it might be to do with the E region. And they could well have been right, because I think you do get that down in the southern hemisphere.
I see.
But anyway, that was a sort of... they were involved with it. But the difference was they were looking horizontally, really. They
right.
had this cliff interferometer. They were looking over the sea, and we were looking at the zenith. And we thought they could have been upset with low-angle fluctuations and things of that sort.
Right, really made it much trickier, I would imagine.
I thought it made it more difficult to sort the thing out.
Yeah. Well, looking at the next publication you have, it's in Proceedings of the Royal Society in 52...
Yeah.
in which you had two aerials 1 kilometer apart.
That's right.
So this was really an extension of the Smith and Little and Lovell.
No, not quite. Well, yes, in a sense, but it was done differently because they were just looking for correlations on a very wide baseline to see if there was any agreement. Because if it was intrinsic, I mean, it would correlate over thousands of kilometers, of course.
Right.
And my interest was to try and measure ionospheric winds and to get the actual structure of the diffraction pattern. I mean, once we knew it was the ionosphere, it was probably a very small-scale pattern on the ground. And my idea was to see correlations, but actually get the drifting pattern and learn something about the ionospheric winds, which I did. I think I was the first person ever to measure an ionospheric wind, actually, using scintillation techniques.
See, I don't have it in the abstract of velocity for... Oh, yes, 100 to 300 meters per second.
That's right.
A height of 400 kilometers. Was this term ionospheric wind only being introduced then? Or?
Well, people were studying the ionosphere by reflection also, and getting this thing. People like, does the name Briggs mean anything to you?
No, I'm afraid
Briggs,
I don't
know. He's one. Well, Ratcliffe and Briggs and others were getting correlations in the reflected wave and getting ionospheric winds out of that.
Right.
And I just extended the same idea, really, essentially, to the transmission through it.
So it's really not, in terms of your published work anyway, until you get to the solar corona occultations that you began doing astrophysics as opposed
right.
to ionosphere.
That's right. Yeah.
Physics.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that is the next publication.
Although
here.
While this was going on, I mean, we're very much an integrated group here, you may have realized, and I was doing design work for radio telescopes all the time. I mean, designing dipole arrays and things
right.
while
right.
this other work was going on. But you don't write papers about how you design antennas, you know. I mean,
yeah,
it's just the astrophysics that comes out.
And,
so,
and you weren't concerned at all with, like you say, I have definitely seen that, and everyone I've talked to is that everyone is chipping into everyone's problems.
Mm,
So were you involved, for instance, in what the nature of these radio stars was?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, regularly we just have a morning session, Saturday morning usually, just sitting around on the floor, you know, saying, what the hell does it all mean?
Was this before the formal ones began? More formal?
Well, they generated from it, really. They generated from that.
I see.
But, I mean, the literature was very easy. Literature coverage was no problem in those days,
right.
You know. One Nature letter every 2 weeks or something.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
and the literature you could hold in, you know, it was about that thick, so that you could really get down to it.
Yeah.
And each new result that came up, you know, we all got around and talked about it.
Was there anyone else in Ryle's group working on... on ionospheric problems as much as you were?
No.
Everyone else is really
doing more. I was always a bit of a loner on that, really. I've sort of had these two interests, you know, the astrophysical ones and the ionospheric.
Well, how did the idea of the Taurus A occultations come up?
That came up. There'd been a prediction that if the sun behaved like a spherically symmetrical ionized cloud with the density decreasing outwards, that you'd get geometrical optics situation so that radiation comes down and gets deviated like that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're observing somewhere down here, the radiation cuts off. I mean, the sun looks like a diverging lens.
Right.
And what you would expect to get under those conditions as you track a radio source past behind the sun would be a sudden cutoff a long way away from the sun where this caustic curve intersects your line of sight. And... that radius, what was called the occultation radius, would have given you the electron density.
Right.
Now, but the records didn't come out looking like that a bit. I mean, the first two times it was tried, I think, were failures because of sunspot activity and so forth. This was the sort of experiment you do every year for the few days that
right.
the Crab Nebula is going past the sun, you see.
Which year was the first year?
Oh, it was around 51, I think, or something like that. There was a Machin and Smith observational paper in Nature which actually showed the curve... it wasn't if you plot the intensity as a function of time, what this would give you would be an intensity which cuts
right.
off very sharply like that. What was actually observed was something much more like that, much shallower, and the suggestion was thrown out that if the solar plasma wasn't bearing smoothly but was in fact a bit ragged, then this thing would be smeared, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, I got interested then, because that was the same thing as the ionospheric scintillation, as far
right.
as I was concerned, except the parameters were all wildly different, but, I mean, it's basically the same phenomenon. And I then interpreted this in terms of the scattering model, you know, and then went ahead and checked that. by seeing if these curves, if the actual scattering angle went as a square of the wavelength.
Oh, yes.
And I did some interferometer records, you know, for some years.
So you were not actually involved in the first torus occultation,
no,
I see.
No.
Like you say, you got interested in it.
Yeah, No, I mean, the result was, it was actually Machen and Smith who did the first observation of that,
mm-hmm.
and showed that it didn't come out looking like it should have done at all.
But now I see that in your article in 55 in the Proceedings of the Royal Society that you talk about irregularities in the sun,
mm.
which was that their original suggestion, are you saying, or that was your interpretation of their...
I think the simplest thing to do is get here in later letter. Have you got these things around?
Well, I don't have that one. I do have a number of reprints here, but I can check that.
I think they probably said something to the effect that an irregular plasma would smear this thing out, something of that sort.
But you worked it out in much more detail.
Well, I put numbers into it.
Yeah, right. Now, well, this is answered for me. In 55, when the 2C survey was published, mm. You and Ryle published a paper describing the aerial, and that was...
Good God, I've forgotten about that.
In the memoirs also.
Oh, yes.
But I didn't realize that you were an aerial designer, and I was just wondering how that came about. So.
No, the dipole arrays that went into that.
Yeah.
I designed most of those.
So I should ask you about the 2C aerial. I mean, were there any technical difficulties in the designing of that, or was it...
Not really. I mean, it was straightforward antenna design.
Once you had the concept of what you wanted to do, then.
Arrays and so forth. I mean, one had to design matching devices and so forth, and get up there and do it. There was no real problem. It was just straightforward engineering, I think.
Let's see. Next thing I have here is at the Jodrell Bank Symposium in 1955. You talked about. I guess this was not actually your own work so much. The solar corona with variable spacing interferometers, that was O'Brien.
I was more or less reviewing that stuff.
Reporting.
Yeah.
I'd be interested in if you could tell me about that meeting. That was really the first meeting.
First IAU symposium in radio astronomy, wasn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
As to really what was the atmosphere, what was going on?
Oh, it was quite interesting, really, because it was the first time the Russians had been let out, really, as far as I can remember, to science. And... I believe that was the meeting where they claimed to have discovered radio emission from deuterium.
I think that's right.
There was.
Or was that the Paris Symposium? Sure which.
I'm pretty sure it was at Manchester, actually. Okay. I think that happened before. And the meeting was hushed, as it were, while this announcement was made, you know, and I don't think people believed it. You may be right. It may have been Paris. I can't quite remember now.
No, I think you're right, because at Jodrell they went and tried to check it, and that was
that's right.
And then they reported on that at the Paris Symposium.
But the interesting thing, from my point of view, I think, was that I discovered that the Russians had been doing very parallel work on the Vitkovich, had been doing the same sort of work, and we got in some arguments and debates about interpretation. And that was it was the Manchester Symposium where I first met. You know this guy, V.V. Vitkovich?
Well, he's died now, unfortunately.
Well, he's died.
I would have liked to have talked to him.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was publishing work and you weren't aware of it because you just...
we didn't read Russian.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we didn't... you don't cover all the literature. I mean, you know, science wasn't the same then as it is now. And I suppose that's really bad for us. But, I discovered then that he'd been doing similar sorts of things. But, you know, there's always been a bit of... imitation. I mean, the sort of things they were doing always looked so closely parallel to ours that I was very suspicious about it, actually. You know, when they said, you know, we've been doing this, you've been doing this a long time before, I was never quite sure about that, actually, because everything that was done looked so similar.
Yeah.
However.
Well, maybe that's a proof that the scientific method has some validity or something.
Could be, yeah.
But what about the state of radio astronomy at that time? Yeah. Was this really the first chance to have an overall worldwide assessment of it, would you say?
Well, it was, more or less. I think it was. This certainly was the first meeting I'd been to. There'd been an IAU meeting, I think, or was it IRSI meetings then that Ryle went to?
Well, 52, I think.
There was a 52 meeting in Rome.
Right.
That's right. Well, now, Ryle went to that. But we were more much... it wasn't so much IAU as IRSI. It was, mm-hmm. was the forum in those early days, because it was a radio technique and wasn't really... We weren't recognized as astronomers, I don't think, in 1955. Scarcely, at any rate.
Right.
I recall it as being there's a lot of meeting where your program of work is changed by going to it.
Yes.
You know, I mean, right. It was a real formative meeting, not like this thing we've been having here, which doesn't really make any difference to what you do.
Yeah.
In those days, you know, in the van coming away from it, I remember we decided, you know, on a complete program of work.
And can you remember specifically what...
More or less. It was, I think, in fact, in the van, we all drove up in this old, crummy old Hillman van, which had punctures here and there. I got a nice picture somewhere of Martin Ryle mending a puncture. We actually camped in the Welsh Hills on the way to Dublin. That was when the IAU was in Dublin.
Yeah, that was 55 also, right?
The symposium was just before that. We went straight from one to the other.
I see.
Camped in the Welsh Hills. But no, it was. In fact, I can remember driving along in that van between Manchester and Holyhead, where we're going to take the boat across, and deciding that what we really should be doing was improving, was getting more accurate positions for these radio sources.